You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, EU and Turkish leaders are meeting in Brussels for an emergency summit on the ongoing refugee crisis. But what else can be done, and will Turkey help stem the flow of migrants? Then we talk about freedom of the press as the Turkish government seizes control of the country's Zaman newspaper. All that plus a look at the results of this weekend's primaries in the United States, and we discuss the legacy of former US First Lady Nancy Reagan too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, right now on Monocle 24. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Xenia Wickett and Quentin Peel. Xenia is the head of the US and Americas programme and dean of the Queen Elizabeth II Academy at Chatham House. And Quentin Peel is the former foreign editor of the Financial Times. Welcome both back to Midori House. Great to have you with us today. And we start the programme in Brussels, where EU and Turkish leaders are meeting as part of an emergency summit on the ongoing refugee crisis. It's expected they will call on Turkey to do more to stop migrants from making the journey across the Aegean Sea to Greece. The crisis continues. It seems even to worsen periodically. Xenia, what's your take on this? In this case, are the right people having the right conversations today?
It's a great question. The good news is I think Turkey is in the room. And that's very, very important. This is not something that the EU can handle on its own. It does need to actually have Turkey in the room. The bad news is the only way to resolve or effectively address the migrant crisis is actually by addressing the problem itself. Why do we have so many migrants coming across? That's a long-term goal. That's clearly not something you can do over the short term. But trying to just deal with the symptoms, which is how do we actually stop people trying to get out of where they are and into Europe, you actually have to deal with that problem rather than just shutting down borders or choosing to take more or less migrants in one or another country. And it doesn't seem to me that there's much effort being put to actually trying to resolve some of the crises that are leading to individuals choosing to migrate.
And Quentin, I guess, as well as there perhaps not being the appetite to tackle those, there's not really any obvious answers, even if people decided they wanted to turn to those causal issues in the first place. But maybe before we come on to that, we've still got, what, maybe 2,000 people arriving on Greek shores every day. Surely we need to even find short-term coping mechanisms to somehow deal with that process.
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, we're talking about something like 130,000 already this year, which is faster than it was last year. And they're building up in Greece now. And I think that actually a hell of a lot's going to have to be done for Greece as a sort of, if you like, a holding camp for a very large number of refugees. And it seems to be, I think people are underestimating the number there must be in Greece already. I think they're disappearing in parts of the country, and that's very difficult. The real problem is, as Xenia said, it's absolutely right that Turkey's in the room. The problem is that Turkey's a very difficult country to deal with at the moment and is doing an awful lot of things that the Europeans are uncomfortable about, not least, for example, actually having a great battle with the Kurds, who are surely one of the European Union, NATO's allies in Syria. So that's a problem already. But the Greeks can't control their own borders. And the only way to find any way to lessen the flow is to try and get Turkey to do more to control people leaving the country. And all of that may perfectly well proved to be illegal under UN regulations that the European Union wants to send everybody back except the Syrians.
But this is why I say you can't just think of it as a European problem. And at the moment, that's how we are thinking of it. Because you've got in Lebanon, you've got over in Jordan, you've got millions of migrants effectively sitting in those countries. And if we don't deal with that, we have a whole new set of problems. So the idea that of saying we can just look at this small subset, which is migrants in Europe, is far too simplistic, because there are all sorts of other problems that if we don't deal with those also, they're going to come back to burn us.
And what about the issue of Turkey? Because as you've mentioned, Zenia, already, you know, positive that they're there. It strikes me as being slightly ironic that so much now of EU migration policy, and maybe more of the EU's future, certainly as an open border zone, depends to a greater or less extent on this country, whose overtures to join the EU, you know, have fallen on deaf ears for a long time, and who, as Quentin just said, can be a rather complicated country to deal with.
It is, and I think we're going to go on to another Turkey story in a moment, but it's... I mean, the Turkish government has essentially said, we want money. You know, 3 billion euros is what the Europeans have offered, but they're saying they've already spent 8 billion. So, you know, there's a question there. They want full visa-free access within the Schengen zone. Well, right at the moment, Europe is having trouble maintaining the Schengen zone, arguably. That's certainly, it's being stretched, shall we say. So that's going to be a real question. They want accelerated talks on EU membership, which again, given the problems that Quentin has mentioned and the problems we're going to go on to talk about, that's certainly in question. And of course, resettling some refugees based in Turkey. Ironically, that might be the easiest of the lot. A little bit of money and a little bit of resettlement. But the other two are going to be extraordinarily hard if we can deal with them at all.
It's interesting, Quentin, that Erdogan repeated this idea that, you know, he and his colleagues and Davutoğlu have been sort of waiting for the money, and he sort of basically told the EU to pony up. Do you think there's something actually almost refreshing about having a very honest, I don't know what you'd call it, transactional discussion about that kind of thing, i.e. you want something done, pay us some money, and it moves forwards? It seems almost honest, at least, if nothing else.
I suppose you could see it like that. I think it reminds me of trying to buy a carpet in a Turkish bazaar. It actually is very difficult to. They've upped all their demands. And Mr. Davutoğlu, just coming to the meeting, seems to have said, I want more money, I want faster visa rights. And again, imagine you're sitting there, one of the leaders of the European Union, saying, I've got a real domestic backlash about taking in so many migrants. So the price of taking in fewer migrants is actually going to be taking in rather more Turkish workers or economic migrants, which is actually what people don't want. So they're really caught between a rock and a hard place. And perhaps the person who's caught most is my good friend Angela Merkel, because she's really needs help from Turkey, and she needs help from her European partners. And at the moment, I'm not sure she's getting either.
There's a kind of, if one can move away from what is a incredibly awful situation in which we sit, there is an interesting kind of sidebar, which is, you know, we're sitting here discussing, in some respects, or many are sitting and discussing whether the EU is going to survive at all this crisis. And yet, one of the incredible strengths of the EU is that you have countries like Turkey who want in, who still want in despite this. So, you know, if one wants to, you were saying you were looking for the upside, that, you know, the glass half full. The glass half full is that there are actually countries who still desperately want into the EU, even while those who are members of the EU are questioning its longevity.
But even if you think about that, I guess you look ahead and you talk about, we mentioned, say, the Turkish relationship with their own internal and nearby Kurdish communities. Let's say Ripple dissolves, somehow Turkey end up joining the EU, for whatever, however likely or unlikely. Isn't that exactly the kind of issue that would expose the same old fissures, which are the difference between the grand design of the project and the fact that people want to make decisions based on their own national interests?
It does, but that's, after all, what Europe was set up to try to resolve, that if one could find a way of at least getting people round a table and practicing jaw-jaw rather than war-war, that is what makes the European Union work. It's a very difficult process, and that's why I think the European Union is getting, you know, less popular, certainly in places like the United Kingdom. But having said that, it is a better answer than going to war.
I don't think anyone would disagree with that at all. Let's move on and talk still about a story that relates to Turkey. Now, over the weekend, the country's largest daily newspaper, the Zaman, was seized by government administrators, and yet another blow to the freedom of the press in the nation, which was brutal anyway. The Sunday edition of the paper, the first following the seizure, displayed a photograph of President Erdogan and a series of broadly pro-regime articles. Not really a smooth transition, though. Armed officials used rubber bullets and tear gas as they took over the offices, and of course that wasn't mentioned at all in the paper's edition. Zeni, what did you make of this? Because we talked often about Turkey's record in jailing journalists, restraining freedom of speech, whether it's social media, the traditional bastions, the printed page. But few people perhaps would have predicted that the, you know, one of the largest dailies would be in the sights. A shock to you as to many others, I imagine.
It's perhaps it shouldn't be a shock. I mean, not just because of Turkey, but if you look at where, let's go back to our earlier discussion, where some EU member states are moving over the last couple of years, Hungary and Poland, to name two, who are, I was about to say slowly but surely, but not necessarily so slowly in some respects, moving away from the kind of Western ideals on which the EU was based, on which membership of the EU was based, that people, states were supposed to be moving towards a direction of openness and transparency and democracy and you know, one man, one vote, etc., etc. And certainly some members within the EU have been moving in the opposite direction. So to some extent, is it any great surprise to us, you know, 3 or 4 years into a movement by Erdogan to gain greater control, if anything, that actually is now really being felt in the media.
Mm. And Quentin, what do you make of this? Because you know, as a newspaper man, as per your introduction, you know, it's just a horrible thing to read about and then to see literally pictures of these things happening.
Yeah, I think as a journalist, it absolutely appalls me. And Turkey's had a really vibrant press and an outspoken press, and I think that's been an enormously important part of its democratic process. Mm. So the idea that, you know, not only the heavies go in and take over the paper, sack the editor, and you know, put in fawning headlines in the first edition that comes out on the streets, it looks like half the journalists are probably going to either be sacked or going to quit. And suddenly the whole thing is weakened. I think it is really quite shocking. And I think that actually, whatever happens on the migration debate with Turkey, it is a real setback to Turkey's ambitions, if it still has them, to join the European Union. That's going to be much more difficult. I think at the end of the day, actually, I believe that Turkey is moving backwards from this process of coming into the European Union, and it may very well decide we don't want to be part of that. And so I think that that is sort of, you've got two things happening at the same time. Turkey's coming together strategically, but certainly tactically, it's moving away.
There was a tweet by Johannes Hahn, the European Enlargement Commissioner, over the weekend, I think it was, saying, "We will continue to monitor this case closely. This Turkey, as a candidate country, needs to respect freedom of the media." And you have to ask your question, would this be happening if the migrant crisis wasn't taking place? So freedom right at the Turkey right at the moment feels like it has a lot of freedom to get some things done that it wants to. And when I say Turkey, I mean Erdogan, has a lot of freedom to get what he wants done, which is, you know, shutting down on the media, shutting down on the opposition, because frankly, we're not going to put up too much of a fuss right at the moment because we need Turkey. I mean, there's a real, as Quentin said, there's a real tactical game being played, one gets the sense. Mm-hmm.
And I think that President Erdogan is rather an unpredictable person these days. And I worry about one other thing, which is that you've got a fairly unpredictable person in Turkey and a fairly unpredictable person running Russia. And the two are more and more at loggerheads over Syria. We could get dragged into an open, hot confrontation between these two countries, which would drag NATO along into a confrontation with Russia, which it's not ready for.
And nobody would want. Just to go back, though, to the newspaper, we often talk about the calculated gambles that Putin and Erdogan make in terms of doing things like giving directives to take over newspapers. And it always strikes me as incredibly short-sighted that to make such a play of doing this and then to produce, you know, fawning editorials the next day. Who's that playing to? I can't believe even the most dedicated fan of Erdogan or Putin, when we've seen things like this happen, can really get anything out of it. And yet you get the ire and the condemnation of international press, other governments that you're trying to negotiate with. It seems ill-considered.
I think, you know, do people in power really think that readers or listeners or watchers of the media are that stupid, particularly in these days of Twitter and of social media and so on, which is much less controlled? And the idea that somehow everybody will say, oh yeah, that's the right news, that says, you know, everything's rosy in the garden, is insane.
But do they actually care? I mean, the reality is that the people who are pro Erdogan are going to think that this was a reasonable thing to do because, of course, Zaman was propagating lies, etc., etc. And the people who are anti-Erdogan are going to continue to be anti-Erdogan. Nobody is going to change their mind based on this. So actually, do they care?
But on the other hand, weren't the people who were reading Zaman, which was supposedly anti-Erdogan, probably anti-Erdogan people?
So exactly, that's
the newspaper's going to have to change all its readers.
Yeah. Well, yes, it'll be interesting to see what the readership of Zaman, happens to the readership of Zaman over the next few months.
On the propaganda side, actually, the man who is showing a very subtle use of propaganda is President Putin in Russia. He's got much more, he's not quite so blatant. He sort of undermines everything, either by just going for entertainment, or by just sowing enough doubt in people's minds about what the truth is that he can get away with it. I think what we're seeing in Turkey is rather a cruder sort of takeover, which I'm not sure. I don't think it will work with the readers and the viewers.
And what does it mean, just finally, for Turkish journalism? Because you already mentioned, Quentin, about, you know, the brilliant journalism we've seen and the role that's played in powering, you know, democratic progress in the country. I mean, it's hard to look. There's obviously been many examples down the years of countries that have very heavy-handed regimes who don't like scrutiny of this sort. But does it mean we have to look to social media instead? Does it mean that traditional journalists, if you like, are going to be denied their forums? You know, do we need to worry about a sort of an existential crisis, if you like, for, you know, proper investigative journalism that holds a government to account?
Yeah, I think we probably do, actually. I think one of the problems is that what one sees on the web is, if you like, the extremes coming out. You get a sort of real battle of misinformation going on. And I think the squeezing of the centre ground of newspapers, of television, or whatever, that attempts at least to provide an objective account of what's happening, it's getting constantly squeezed and it's under a great deal of threat because not making any money. And democracy won't survive without at least a moderately decent source of information to inform the voters.
Zenia, it's interesting. I just wonder, what do you think that kind of, you know, government scrutiny that maybe goes beyond just an interest in what journalists are doing into intimidation, in this case, a complete takeover. What does that do to somebody's, you know, mindset? Do now even, I don't know, moderate journalists or, you know, maybe even nationalists, does it start to make people, you know, it's an additional layer of editing maybe that happens now?
Well, so on the side of the journalists, it clearly is going to be an increase in another layer of self-censorship, effectively. You know, if I write that, I might get, fired. So I'm going to write something that is much more benign than I would otherwise do and is certainly vastly less honest. But there's also a real cost to Erdogan. I remember vividly working on Pakistan when President Mushraf was still the lead there. And the last couple of years, I mean, he was truly surrounded by sycophants, by people who just told him what he wanted to hear. And if you read his book, I'm about to say it's called In the Line of Fire. This is back in kind of 2007-ish. He clearly believes everything he says. And to an external audience, you just kind of go, that's an interpretation that has no reflection of reality. But clearly he was surrounded by people who said, yes, sir, absolutely, sir, your interpretation is absolutely right. And it was very dangerous. And of course, Musharraf eventually had to step down and now is in all sorts of trouble. And I believe still under house arrest.
But still believes he was right.
Yeah. Exactly. And so you kind of, you can equate that, if you will, you know, who knows whether that's how it will play out in Turkey. But here was a leader in Pakistan who did lots of good things for the country, as Erdogan did for a number of years, but then found himself surrounded by people who believed what he said and stayed on too long, and look at them now. And so I think there's a real danger for Erdogan as well, that he is creating an environment in which nobody can say anything that is contrary to his own set of beliefs. And that's not healthy for him either.
Absolutely. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, my guests, Zeny Wickett and Quentin Peel. Up next, we'll examine the results from the weekend's primaries in the United States. Stay tuned.
The Foreign Desk is getting a little brother, the Foreign Desk Explainer. Each week, we'll look at one of the world's biggest issues and, well, explain it. The Foreign Desk Explainer is a 5-minute nugget of information, analysis and opinion, and you can download it every week from iTunes, SoundCloud or, of course, Monocle.com. The Foreign Desk Explainer, available right now from Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and my guests today, Zeny Wickett and Quentin Peel. We head to the United States now, following another weekend of voting and caucuses and such like. On the Democrat side, Bernie Sanders has beaten Hillary Clinton in the main vote, while in the Republican race, Marco Rubio easily won Puerto Rico's primary, beating Donald Trump. I think he was the only person to do any campaigning there, so perhaps that one was easier to predict. Zeny, what did you make of the weekend's results? It seemed largely, perhaps, expected. Did you learn anything? Can you read anything in the sort of tea leaves from the weekend that's maybe moved this general discussion on a little?
Not really. On the Democratic side, I think it was as to be anticipated. Doesn't really change any of the numbers in any real sense. Clinton is still way ahead of Bernie Sanders in terms of delegates, and there's absolutely no reason to believe that she's not going to scoop the nomination. Probably effectively, I mean, if she hasn't already done it, it's going to be in the coming weeks to make it effectively impossible for Bernie to beat her. The only thing, and you're seeing that in the debates. So they had a debate last night, and you did see Bernie Sanders be far more aggressive and far more agitated than he had previously. Mm. I mean, one of the really interesting things about the Democratic debates is how civilized it has been, and how both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have, for the most part, actually said pretty good things about one another, which is, of course, entirely the opposite of what's happening in the Republican debate. And I'm not even going to go into what the latest conversation was between the candidates. The Republican side is a little bit more interesting. You know, certainly if you'd asked 2 weeks ago, back in March 1st, I guess that's a week ago now, you know, there was a sense, you know, Rubio won a state. But I mean, there was a sense a week or two ago that Rubio was perhaps beginning to get some support, particularly as Jeb Bush, you know, stood down, Chris Christie stood down, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what you would say coming out of this weekend is Rubio really doesn't have it. It really is between Trump and Cruz. The only circumstances under which Rubio really still has a voice is insofar as if between Rubio, Kasich and Cruz, they can prevent Donald Trump from actually winning enough delegates so that you go to a contested convention in July. In that sense, the only really interesting thing coming out of this weekend is actually Cruz was remarkably strong, did show some signs of weakness. Trump showed some signs of weakness. But the real question remains, will it be a contested convention or will Trump win the day?
Quentin, what do you make of that big question, I suppose, which is it seems almost like something awoke in the last even just week or so. The rhetoric wasn't that different, but it seemed like certain maybe people, maybe Mitt Romney's involvement seemed to spark something. The GOP saying, look, we really need to do something about this now. Is it all going to be about the conventions, do you think, and whether there's a way of mobilizing against Trump?
I think that looks like the last hope of the Republican Party establishment before they go into complete meltdown. The only way to stop Trump is to have just about enough other votes for a contested convention where they get blocked and try another route. But it's looking quite slim. Mm. And, Cruz against Trump, the devil in the deep blue sea, from a European perspective. I don't think that there'd been no great surprises. Although, no, Cruz Cup did better than we expected, I think.
And Trump did worse.
Trump did worse, but neither of them represents, and both of them are disliked intensely by the Republican Party establishment. Mm. So the Republican Party is in a real mess and a muddle, but having somebody like Mitt Romney come out, having John McCain come out against them, hasn't made that much difference.
Well, and I wanted to ask on this point, Zenia in particular, will it be the end of the GOP as we know it if Trump wins? I know it's still a little early, but it feels like end days unless somebody or something galvanizes a resistance at the convention.
No, I mean, I think it's an interesting, Quentin kind of implied it, you know, who is worse for the Republican Party, Trump or Cruz? And it's a really good question. Cruz represents the far right of the Republican Party. I mean, he does represent an extremely conservative part of the Republican Party, one that most establishment Republicans, most Republicans, would say there's absolutely no way he can get elected as president. He doesn't represent enough of the middle of America. You know, that's the end of the Republican Party. Trump represents something entirely different. Trump has actually remarkably harnessed new voters. Far more people have come out to vote because of Trump. Trump isn't terribly conservative, and one of the sticks that he's being beaten with at the moment is how he's funded Hillary Clinton in the past. How actually on a number of issues from, you know, abortion, you know, on, he doesn't hold conservative views. And so actually Trump is, notwithstanding his rhetoric, his persona, which I think would be incredibly damaging to the Republican Party, and certainly they feel it is, his views are almost too moderate for most of the Republicans. And that's what makes it so interesting. But what it means is this is not new in some respects. I mean, you know, the Trump persona is clearly very, very new. But Trump described himself over the last couple of days as a unifier, not a divider. And he has some evidence to back up the fact that he's actually bought people out who you wouldn't normally expect to be voting for Republicans. So, you know, the Republican Party, as has the Democrats, much like the Tories and the Labour Party, have waxed and waned, divided and come together over decades. This is yet one more case. What is interesting to me is that what you're getting in Trump is somebody, he really is a new voice for the Republican Party in some respects. You would have thought that the divide would be over somebody like, I'm trying to think, you know, Kasich, who is really quite moderate, and Cruz on the conservative side. That's what we would have anticipated.
Does this speak to a bit of a problem with, you know, two-party systems, I guess? It's interesting you mentioned we've had sort of discussions about this with the Conservative and Labour in this country. Do you think that's true, Quentin, that really what Trump's success, at least thus far, demonstrates is that people have an appetite for something else, and the traditional labels have become increasingly academic?
Well, I think that's certainly what we're seeing in the Trump phenomenon. This is the outsider. This is somebody who's appealing to those who are fed up with the establishment in both parties. And in fact, I think Cruz is also appealing to that. Whether that produces a candidate who is electable, or does it hand actually the result to Hillary Clinton on a plate, in spite of the fact that thus far she hasn't actually fought a terribly impressive election campaign? So I think that there is this phenomenon of rebellion, of revolt against the centre, which we're seeing in Britain, we're seeing in Europe, and we're seeing in America, which I think for traditional two-party system, I mean, we no longer have two-party systems in Europe, really. They've already shrunk.
The time is short, and I did just want to come to the last story of the day, which was the news at the weekend of the death of the former First Lady, Nancy Reagan, who died aged 94, a definitive figure of 1980s politics and social history, I guess, almost for the US. First Lady from 81 to 89. The force behind Reagan's presidency, some people said. Zenia, how do you look back on Nancy Reagan's contribution? Because it was interesting that she was certainly one of the first ladies who became a bit more political, I suppose.
Absolutely. I mean, I think she really is, in some respects, the as you say, she was one of the first ladies to really kind of developed this idea of, I mean, she was incredibly supportive of her husband, both in the presidency and after it, really very much supporting him, putting forward his views. She had a very strong role in their relationship. And I think this was one of the first ladies who had such a visibly strong role, but also left it very much to him to be the president, to be the leader, to be the figure. But all of the editorials about it over the weekend just indicate quite how strong of a figure she was, as I say, both as a first lady and afterwards, and how important they were to one another. I mean, it's really is quite special. You don't often see people write this way about famous couples.
Indeed. Quentin, I don't know, do you have a five-second thought about what Nancy's real legacy will be?
I don't think Ronald Reagan would have become US president without her. I think that she was the real metal behind him, a cold woman, but a passionately devoted woman.
There you go. That's Quentin Peel's insights. We heard too from Xenia Wickett. Thanks both for joining us here on Midori House today. It's all we have time for on today's programme. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Monaghan. Our studio manager today has been Toby Hammond. Join us at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. Thank you very much for tuning in.